Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today it's Tony Robinson with No Cunning Plan.
This is indeed the book which was being referred to, and it is indeed available at Waterstones at the end. And I'm guessing, Tony, that this is something that you've been talking about a lot. You've been going around discussing your career and your life, which you say in this. But hopefully today we're going to have a slightly different angle, because of course this is a history festival, and so we thought we would focus very much on the kind of historical dimension of your career, which is, of course, fairly considerable. Your association with history in the public mind, I guess, begins with Blackadder. But I wonder, when you were a child, were you interested in history, or was history kind of dumped in your lap as a result of the casting agency that got you the role in Blackadder?
Before I answer that question, can I flip the roles and be interviewer for a second and ask you to tell these good people what you just told me about you and this field and being a little boy?
Okay. It's not as bad as it sounds, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm sure many of you will be familiar with this if you come from this region and if you've heard maybe me talk about this before. But Church Bottom, where this amazing festival is being held, is celebrated for being haunted by the ghost of a Roman centurion. And I met up with my cousin, who we used to come and stay with us, and we would slip out early in the morning before my parents, who were sitting there, so I can now break it to them. We would slip out of the window without them knowing and come here and look for the ghost of the Roman centurion. And one day we were walking along the path and there were some cows, and suddenly the cows started running, and that was clearly conclusive proof that the centurion is really here. And so it is amazing for me to come here and see all these tents, but even more to see actual Roman centurions walking around as well. So yes, so thank you for that question.
I think it's amazing that all those hundreds, indeed thousands of years ago, there was that stiff-backed patrician in this field, and he was still here at 3:30 this afternoon.
I know, and how puzzled he must be. He's been waiting, you know, 600 years for some Romans to turn up, and here they are. But Tony, this is not about me or Roman centurions, it's about you. So tell us about, were you interested in any way in history, or was it dumped?
Well, I didn't realise that it was called history. My mum and dad were ordinary East End working class kids, and my dad was very bright. None of the people in my parents' family, and they go back at least 300 years as far as I've been able to find, either in Shoreditch or Hackney or else in Colimbourne Ducis and Colimbourne Kingston, but none of them had ever been to university. My dad was really, really bright. He won a place at London University, and he couldn't go because he was the second son of a working class family. And in those days, that just didn't happen. And so he joined, very much as a foot soldier, the London County Council, which was structured just like the army or the navy or the colonial service in those days, very much of a pyramid with the rulers on the top and the foot soldiers way at the bottom. And he worked really, really hard at home in the living room above the tobacconist in Amos Road in Hackney, where my grandparents lived, until he managed to pass his exams to, as it were, be in the officer class of the London County Council. And because suddenly my mum and dad had accrued that much money, they bought a semi-detached house in South Woodford, that Xanadu at the end of the rainbow, down the Leabridge Road, where they could live this glorious lower middle class life. And that happened for about 6 months, and then war was declared. And my dad went off to the east coast of Scotland to work in the RAF. My mum went to Reading to be in the WAF. And you can imagine that neither of them had what you might call a glorious war. They didn't win medals or anything. But it was such a liberating experience for this very ordinary couple to suddenly be having adventures and meeting people and going to places they would never, ever have done before. So when the war was over, they came back and they were full of these stories about what had happened to them in the previous 5 years. It was literally the time of their lives. And I was born in 1946, so really from the moment that I was born, I was being bombarded with all these stories about the war. I was born exactly a year after VJ Day, so it wasn't actually very long ago. But of course, to me, it seemed like the Middle Ages. And yet they were telling me all these stories, and I just loved them. And of course, they would tell me, as parents do, the same stories over and over again, and I was just gradually imbued by them. And until when I was about 10, and I remember this conversation terribly well, I was at school, and we were doing this subject, and the teacher said, we're going to mark this at the end of term. And I said, well, what is it? Which is a rather odd question. And the teacher said, it's called history. And I had no idea that this concept existed until that moment.
And then did you discover that the Second World War and your parents' reminiscences were actually part of this thing called history?
Well, this thing called history. But again, Tom, I think, you know, the great weaponry for me, it wasn't that there was just my mum and dad in the First World War, the Second World War. There was my granddad in the First World War, which he never talked about.
And well, which he knew about, which did you?
I knew about it. But
you knew that he'd done it, but the fact that he didn't talk about it made it something that you were
exactly,
aware of.
Exactly, it was kind of magic, wasn't it? He came back in 1918 from the Western Front, covered in mud and crap and everything, and he stepped into the parlour. My grandmum spread out the newspapers on the parlour floor. You can imagine the tiny little fire blazing. My dad and my uncle Cyril, probably about I don't know, 9 and 11. Who is this guy who's just arrived? They're sitting nervously on the sofa. This guy, this muddy guy, starts taking off his jacket and his shirt and his vest and his trousers, his boots and his trousers. My grandma gets them all into this huddle on the newspaper, throws them onto the fire. And then they all sit there for what to my dad seemed like the whole of the rest of the evening, watching this uniform turn into this clag. And my granddad was like hovering over it. And then he disappeared up to the bedroom. I shouldn't get off this chair because I have to get back on again every time. He disappeared up to the bedroom and he never ever spoke about it again. But as you can imagine,
so it's an absent presence.
Absolute, completely that. And I've got loads of photographs of him and it's kind of eerie. He was a joker, my granddad. But I look at those photos and I see that smile, but I see a pain in his eyes as well, and I don't know if that's real or if I'm just kind of imbuing his past with some kind of romance. But I always knew that story. And if that was true of my granddad, it must have been true of his parents and his parents and his parents and his grandma and her grandma and her grandma. I got the fact that I was part of this extraordinary continuum of the adventure of our species, which we call history. And I've always thought what an extraordinary weapon that is for a young child to have, to realise that they are not constricted by what they are experiencing now. Their understanding doesn't have to be constricted by that, because they are part of this crazy, wonderful helter-skelter, and there have been trillions of people just like them who've had those kind of adventures. Now, and I think regardless of how well or how badly you do at school, to be able to understand experience in that way is absolutely wonderful, which is why in addition to my autobiography, there are several of my children's books in the tent over there, but that is
I was really getting moved there, and now you've suddenly... I mean, I guess that looking ahead to your future involvement in history, what you've said there really provides a context for Blackadder Goes Forth, but also for Time Team, your interest in how people in the very distant past lived as well.
Yeah.
So clearly that is something that was there in your childhood and has been kind of burning inside you. But it's also evident from the way that you've described it, the way you've got on and off your seat, the way you've almost knocked me off my seat with your hand, your gesticulations, that you were clearly born to be an actor. and indeed a children's presenter.
Yeah.
Because at one point you were presenting Play Away, I gather.
P-L-A-Y.
Okay, so I just asked, how many people remember that?
Yeah, I think that was very much to do with my dad. I realised pretty late in the day, Tom, and I know you'll get this too, because you're just as much of an old ham as I am.
No, I'm really not.
No, you really are. That nursery rhymes, the first time, by and large, that most of us experience a nursery rhyme is when we are maybe a month old, 2 months old, we're being held. It is just about the most secure we can be, and our mum or our dad are just bobbing around. So it's about rhythm, and it's about love, and it's about security. And then as they get, you know, the kid gets a little bit older, you begin to be able to understand the bumpty dumpty diddly poo, dumpty dumpty. Ooh, had a great fall. It's also about precariousness, but it's about precariousness and threat within this incredibly warm setting. And then as you get older, you realise, bloody blimey, there's a big egg in this. And you get the understanding of Humpty Dumpty, and then you get this thing, which is a book, which you've thought was just something for swacking yourself or somebody else with, and then you can open it up and realise it has a different phenomenon within it. It has the big egg out of the Dumpty Dumpty thing. And then you go to school and you realise that everybody else knows the Dumpty Dumpty Humpty Dumpty, and then you get to about 13 or 14 and you go, oh, well, actually, it's a satire on a Georgian general. And it's probably about a large gun called Humpty Dumpty, or possibly it's about the futility of the Georgians, and you just so love that because you're in control of this thing. And then you get to be an adult and you have kids and you're doing it all again.
And you're doing it on Playway, yeah, and you're going through the round window.
Yeah, yeah. And having felt that I had that in spades with my mum and dad, I missed it out because I just missed it out. But one of the things about my dad, that one of his big adventures in the Air Force was that there were loads and loads of Canadians in East Scotland at that time, and they had a boogie band and they needed a new pianist. And my dad said, I'll do that. And he knew nothing about boogie piano, but he kind of learned on the job. And those first stills that I have of my dad in that jazz group, he's right on the end, you know, you imagine a still of five or six people with the saxophone and all that. The piano, you can just about see my dad's nose and his hands. By the end of the war, he's right in the middle, you know, doing all that. And he just loved that kind of performance. But he could have gone back to Canada gone over to Canada to be a boogie pianist with those guys when the war ended. But because they bought that house in South Woodford, I think he thought he wanted to invest in that whole dream of semi-detached life. So he went back there. But both my parents, my mum spent the whole of the war defending Britain from Hitler by doing amateur dramatics. It was ridiculous. But they'd obviously got all that stuff inside them, and I think they just imbued me with all that.
You called me a ham. I'm not a ham.
That's all you remember.
No, but I am now going to reveal myself as being very pretentious, because what I want to ask you in the context of Blackadder is everything that you've said, there's a kind of, you're talking about the nursery rhyme, that there's a kind of a primal quality to that, and then you know all about the Georgians and the guns and all that kind of thing. Yeah. And there's a sense in which the character that you play in Blackadder, as it emerges, particularly from the first series into the second series, that there's a kind of absurdity there that is simultaneously very profound and serious. That in a sense it bears no relationship to history, and yet it's the absolute marrow of history. And the thing that am I being pretentious here? Stop me if I am. But the thing that really brings that into the spotlight is that in the first series, which is set in the 15th century against the backdrop of the Wars of the Roses, Prince Blackadder is the idiot, really, and you are the sensible sidekick. And that's a kind of classic from all kinds of dramas. And then in the Elizabethan one, it's tucked on its head, and suddenly you're having your cunning plans and your turnips and things like that. And suddenly, it's much more about class, and it's much more about the way that the elites have related to the people who they employ as servants and to pick turnips. Am I being pretentious in saying that or not?
No, although I don't think... We didn't do that deliberately. I think there were a series of attitudes towards life, towards politics, towards history, that in some way that group of people all shared. Although most of the time it was unspoken. What we were focusing on was the work. But we didn't really know the direction the series was heading in.
Is that the first one or the second
one? The first one. Rowan and Richard loved those old late 50s and early 60s half-hour television adventure shows, most of which were on children's television, which were very swashbuckling, like Robin Hood, like Ivanhoe, The Buccaneer. They were a glorious half hour, I think, for anyone who lived through that time. They're really transporting. And they wanted to do a television series which brought that to life. But they were also fiendish history fans themselves. And so the pilot was, as you say, written in the War of the Roses. But actually what they did was to turn the whole plot of the real War of the Roses on its head and have Richard III killed before he became king, and the Plantagenets last much longer than they did in the real world, and it was a complete usurping and rewriting of English history, which is all very well, except nobody knows anything about the Wars of the Roses anyway, so the idea that you're undermining it on BBC One at 9 o'clock makes no sense at all, because nobody knows what you're doing. So it was very arcane in many ways and very confusing. So on a cerebral level, it wasn't quite working. On a slightly more populist level, there weren't enough good jokes in it. So Rowan very gratefully decided that he would give up being a writer on it. I mean, gratefully in both senses. I think he was glad to be relieved of the responsibility, but also I think we all felt there was enormous... we had a great deal of gratitude towards him because it was a very generous thing to do. It was, after all, his show. And he wanted someone to write alongside Richard Curtis, who could bounce off Richard, be very sympathetic to this broad historic panoply, but at the same time write good knob jokes, if you'll excuse the reality of the situation. So, and really, it was a short list of one. There was one person who had transformed British comedy writing more than anyone else in the last 10 years, and that was Ben Elton with his Young Ones. He was one of the few very big fans of the first Blackadder series, so he was invited to come in and write with Richard. And they both agreed that they wanted a much simpler vision of history, which was one that everyone could share. And certainly, you know, nowadays, as far as school is concerned, the one part of British history that everyone teaches and learns is the Tudors. There's something so kind of strong and, in a sense, easy to grasp about that writing about Elizabeth I.
So why Elizabeth I, not Henry VIII? Because Henry VIII would complicate it with the wives.
I think that's right. I mean, realistically, you had to think about casting, and you didn't... And we were told, we weren't given a second series for 18 months. It just didn't do the ratings. And eventually we were told we could do a second series, provided we did it on half the money. So that meant, first of all, no grand filming. And the first half, an awful lot of the first series was filmed around Alnwick Castle. And secondly, we would have to dramatically reduce the cast. So really... Henry VIII was right, although in a sense, six episodes would have been.
But I wonder also, I mean, you know, Elizabeth I is the patron of Shakespeare. So that idea of having comedy in a room, subliminally perhaps it works, that there's a kind of Shakespearean echo. Again, am I being pretentious there?
I think you're kind of half right, and I'm not saying that in a patronising sense. what Ben said was the problem with Blackadder the First was that there was no real dynamic, the kind of dynamic that you would get in the classic 60s and 70s sitcoms that had influenced us all so much. He wanted it essentially to be about two rooms which our anti-hero moved between. One, like in Hancock, surrounded by his mates, in which he could be the king, and the other, in the outside world, in which he could be exposed for the idiot that he actually was. So in one of those two rooms, i.e. Blackadder's kitchen, he had to be surrounded by people who were deeply impressed by him, in which he could cook up all these wonderful schemes, which meant that he had to have two dullards that he was surrounded by. And that was where the idea of this cosmically stupid Baldrick came from. Then, in the other world...
How did they mention that to you? They said, you know, you were the smart guy in the first series, now we want you to be really dumb. So how did... Were you happy with that?
Because it came as part of a package. I mean, I think as an actor, it's like people say to me sometimes, oh my God, how could you possibly have ever appeared in the nude? The answer to that is, you don't primarily perceive of it being in the nude, you think of it as wearing a really good comic costume. Yeah. Certainly in my case. And like being very stupid, suddenly I kind of got it. Yeah. The thing about being very stupid is that if you think of Bilko, for instance, any of you in this room who are old enough to remember Bilko, which is quite a lot of you, the thing that made Phil Silver's character work was he was surrounded by these two really dumb people who made him feel so confident that he could go into this other world, which in our Elizabethan world was surrounded by all the purses and likewise as epitomised by Stephen Fry and be thwarted. So that was, it was a whole package.
Yeah.
And part of that package was that we would have this really attractive but really manipulative young Queen Elizabeth.
A kind of school prefect.
Yeah, yeah. But the first week, we were in real trouble because we'd cast this brilliant, quirky young actress who not very many people knew at the time, Miranda Richardson. And neither Ben or Richard really knew how to write for women. I mean, you didn't in those days, he said in inverted commas. You know, most of those people really struggled to write for women. So in a sense, Miranda had to create the character herself and then offer it back to the writers to do something with it. And the first two or three days was agony, everybody pacing up the room, chain smoking, trying to find a character that worked. Suddenly Miranda got it. And I just remember the moment to this day. And she started speaking in this voice. And you knew she was kind of on the cusp of ponies and sex.
Yes.
And was like every irritating 14-year-old,
yes,
except she happened to be the most powerful woman in the world.
Yes.
And once you knew that,
yes,
it was a gift for the writers.
Yes, and kind of true to maybe how Elizabeth actually operated in a kind of comical sense.
I think, well, you know what you were saying about as far as history is concerned, it's nonsense, but in a way it isn't.
Yeah.
It was written by people who essentially had two main passions. One was history and the other was comedy.
Yeah.
So in a way, we never ever wanted to betray the history. And so we developed a morality.
Yeah.
Can you get that?
Yeah. It had to be true. You know, it was funny, but it had to go with the grain of the history.
Exactly that.
And so that then leads on to my question in the context of series three, set in the Regency period, and series four, of course, set in the First World War. That to what extent do you think that the comedy in both those series, which were quite distinct, were shaped and influenced by the period in which they were set?
That's a very good question. I think the thing that drove series three was Hugh Laurie's performance.
A royal that was grotesquely inappropriate to the real figure and yet completely true to it.
Yes, exactly that.
And was that something that Hugh Laurie developed, or was that always there?
I think it was very. I do think that was very much Hugh. By that time, when we first started writing, because I'm not supposed to be a writer, am I? At least as far as that's concerned. When we started, it was in a sense very hierarchical, in that you had the script, the director, the producer up there, just like any sitcom. But because most of them had all worked together in Oxford and Cambridge, that didn't really work. You couldn't have that power structure, and indeed nobody really wanted that to happen. It worked much better as a collaboration, and it became more and more of a collaboration until by the end of it. Ben and Richard would leave on the Monday, having given us the script. By the Friday, when they came back, it often bore very little relationship to how it had been at the beginning of the week. Therein lying not only an enormous amount of creativity, but a huge amount of creative tension and eventually quite a lot of bad feeling, although that was essentially resolved. But it did mean that by the time we got to Blackadder the Third, it was very collaborative. And there was something, it was terribly audacious, the idea that, again, we would write a comedy series about a period in history which none of our viewers would have a clear purchase on at all.
Well, I'm trying to think, you know, the one thing that people do know about that period is Highwaymen.
Yeah.
So you have that.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And you had Miranda Richardson in it.
Yeah, yeah.
But Dr. Johnson,
if you look back at Blackadder and think, do I really know which George was associated with that particular episode? It is very
Or the Rotten Boroughs. Complicated. I mean, again, you know, very funny historical joke, but Georgian history is not really something that people study.
And how audacious! I was surrounded by these dazzling minds, absolutely dazzling. All, I have to say, 10 years younger than me, and all so much more confident than me, who actually were prepared to write a half-hour comedy for primetime BBC One about Rotten Boroughs. It was just so brilliant. And at that time, we had so much confidence that it never even occurred to us that it wouldn't work as a concept. And yet, what always worried us was that it wouldn't be funny enough. And Hugh was the worst at that. Hugh Laurie, who is now perceived as this kind of smoulderingly sexy, incredibly witty, confident man, by the time we went on the Saturday evening, we would be queuing up, ready to be introduced to the audience, which was, you know, maybe two-thirds the size of this one. No one can see us because of the black curtains there. We're all on the steps there, and we're all slightly nervous, except for Hugh, who's going, "Oh, shite, no, shite, no, shite, no, shite, no, shite, no, shite. I'm so unfunny. I'm going to be exposed this time." And on anybody else, that would have been really irritating. On Hugh, it was charming, because he really meant it. He was so, so vulnerable. And it was, in a sense, I think it was more those kind of preoccupations that drove the series. And as far as Series 4 was concerned, that, I think...
Okay, yes.
That's more true. What your perception there is much more true.
But you know, you're saying you're going to make comedy out of Rotten Boroughs or Dr. Johnson, but making comedy out of the Battle of the Somme, I mean, that's a different order. How nervous was everyone? I mean, was that always the way you were going to go, or was there debate about it? Was there consideration this could really go horribly wrong? Because
we
it is
were
something,
very
you know, because you're talking about your grandfather.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this is the stuff of living memory, and people are very sensitive about it.
And for Ben too. I mean, Ben's parents and his grandparents, relatives who both fought in the war and, of course, suffered in the camps. For Ben Elton, it was very raw. And Ben, more than anyone else, drove us towards the notion of doing a series that was set in the First World War.
And was it always the plan that it would end as it did? Which, of course, you all know that it has this unbearably kind of elegiac end.
We knew from the beginning that we wanted to make a definite socio-political statement, if you like. We are not making jokes about the sacrifice of the men who died. This is about the madness that led to the sacrifice of the
people. Because the villain is Stephen Fry's...
It is,
general
but in
Melchett,
a way,
really.
Yes,
and
although
it's the whole apparatus of the war.
It's the apparatus of the war. It's the madness that surrounds Stephen Fry's character, really, isn't it? And it's the madness of the Eton playing fields that that bolster the idiocy of Hugh Laurie's character. It's the fact that as far as Rowan's character is concerned, the South African war and the futility of that is still in his mind. From Baldrick's point of view, it's knowing the wave after wave of futility and the Schweikian quality that any private had to adopt in order to survive. So it was all of that that we were deeply aware of, and it was all of that that led to that final episode. But just briefly, the other thing, and again, because half of what you're saying is right and half of it was very different preoccupations, it was also because we wanted to write this really claustrophobic sitcom like Steptoe, where everyone feels locked in to a situation in such a desperate way that you have to kind of break out of it. Harry H. Corbett's character, I mean, it was desperate, Harry H. Corbett's character was. He just had to get out of that junkyard. And in the same way, Rowan has to get out of that trench. And the idea of a comedy set in a trench was pitched to us and what we thought was so wonderful.
So I wonder how you feel, but because of, you know, the first three series, in a sense, are kind of parasitic on history would be the wrong word. They're using history to provide the context. With the fourth series, something rather strange and different happened, in that the portrait of the war that you gave became shorthand for a particular understanding of the war as having been a futile, a waste, that the generals were all incompetent. And it's kind of the Blackadder view of the First World War has become a kind of shorthand, and I've heard it used, you know, in this history festival by people talking about saying, well, actually, Haig wasn't quite as bad as people said. Maybe this was a war that was necessary. You must feel an incredible sense of pride that something that you've been involved in has actually kind of altered the way in which people understand such a significant episode in history, that it's part of a controversy, a historical controversy.
It's one of the things I am proudest of, the idea that nowadays in schools, teachers show that final episode as an entree into an understanding of the First World War. I had a spat with Michael Gove a number of years ago in which he argued that Blackadder shouldn't be shown in schools, and it certainly shouldn't be incorporated into the GCSE syllabus because it gave such a partial view of the war. I argued against what he was saying on a number of grounds. Firstly, well, he was saying that it was comedy, therefore it was inappropriate. I don't think that comedy is the opposite of serious. I think that trivial is the opposite of serious. And one thing we always tried not to be was trivial. We always wanted to be comic. And I think that comedy is one of the best ways of making things stick in people's minds. So I think that that is very useful for teachers. I also think that when teachers use something like Blackadder, they're not saying to their kids, this is what the First World War was, any more than by introducing Rupert Brooke or Wilfred Owen to children, they are saying, this is what the First World War was. It all rhymed. You know, that's not the sense of it, is it? It is the beginning of an introduction into what the First World War was. So I disagree with him in that sense. I also disagree with him about this notion of the officer class. The fact is, and you'll know more about this than I do, that after the English Civil War was over, the new ruling class said, we can never, ever have a people's army ever again. We must always have an army that is tied in to the status quo, and the way to do that is to make sure that the officers always are part of the landed gentry. And that was true until the 19th century. And even after those restrictions were theoretically removed, that was still very much the culture of the forces. So there was very much this kind of locked-in series of parameters which abounded at the beginning of the First World War. And I think it is no coincidence that very many of the most creative generals in the latter part of the First World War were actually from the colonies, from New Zealand, Monash from Australia, the Canadians, who didn't have that hierarchical vision because they weren't part of the culture of the Boer War, of the playing fields of Eton, stretching right back to the Civil War. So I think that our vision of the First World War was absolutely justified, but I also think you're right. By that time, we had been working together on and off for the best part of a decade, and we shared a view of the world that came out, you know, it wasn't just Blackadder that came out of that group of people. Comic Relief came out of that group of people too. We shared a vision of the world, which I think
You then went on to write Maid Marian and Her Merry Men, which kind of took a similar perspective on the story of Robin Hood, who turned out to be not all he was cracked up to be, and of course it was Maid Marian. So is that presumably reflecting a similar political perspective?
Yes. It came out of the fact that I'd been working in a historical comedy series and I wanted to try and work that out in my own mind rather than being in a lot of senses, even though it was so collegiate. But nevertheless, there are other people running the show who weren't me. So I wanted to work that out. Also, I think I learned an awful lot about how to write from Richard Curtis. Richard was incredibly generous with his time, and I wrote, prior to Maid Marian, a number of children's books, the first ones of which I wrote with Richard. He didn't particularly want to write them with me, although he was happy to oversee them, as it were, but I was insistent that his name should be on them. But he gave me confidence to be a writer, and it was kind of wonderful that I was actually getting an Oxbridge writing education just because it was my mate who I was going to. And he, you know, I would write the first couple of chapters and he would look at them and he would say, these first five pages, you're just writing yourself into the story here. Take away those first five pages. The story still exists, doesn't it? Why are you writing that servant woman there? Who is she? I don't know anything about her. Well, I either get rid of her or make me invest in her. Give me something interesting about her. And then, a third of the way through the book, you can reintroduce herself, and actually she becomes a little firework who can then explode and advance the plot even more. And look at that gag there. It is so slow in developing. Tighten it up, less words. And when you get to the gag itself, bomb, 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 choose the words really well and then get a subsidiary gag afterwards. You know, all those kinds of things, which I had been half learning while I was doing Blackadder. Oh, when I was writing these books, his words kept drumming into my head until gradually I started writing ahead of his notes. Until by the time I got commissioned to write the fourth book, I rang him up and said, would you mind, Richard, if I do this one on my own? Because your voice is always in my head. I actually don't need you to criticize me, because as soon as I read back my own work, I know what you're going to say anyway. And he said, that is the moment I've been waiting for. And it was an enormous emotional generosity. He didn't have to spend all this time. You know, I get these free lessons from the man who became the most successful English Hollywood writer in history. And it cost me, you know, the price of sharing a children's book royalties with him.
Right, I'm going to ask you one more question, and then I'm going to open up the floor, because I'm sure everyone is queuing up to ask. Everything that you have, everything that you've said, everything that you've done in your career reflects the fact that you are a man of deeply held political principles and ideals, and you've been on the Labour National Executive, and you were speaking at the weekend rally against Brexit. Do you feel that there's a kind of continuum between your the roles that you've played in particularly Blackadder, the role that you've played in Time Team, that your concern is with, you know, not with the generals and the kings, but with how everyday people have lived, with your politics?
Yes, I think so. And I think, again, I think that goes back to my dad, who wasn't a Labour at all. I think his vision of a good Britain would have been a sort of a leftist Tory government with a very strong Attlee type Labour opposition. I think that was, you know, that's what he would have liked to have seen. But he was, both of my parents were passionate about education. They always wanted to see, their vision was education, but education without using the word. I always feel slightly embarrassed by using the word education, because
education.
No, understanding the world more, understanding the world even more than that. That to me is what empowers people, and that to me has always been magic, and that to me is. I've always been passionate about politics in a way with a small p rather than. Yeah. Than the passion. I mean, I must say, regardless of how you feel about Brexit, you can understand from my point of view, I stood up, a week ago on a platform and spoke to somewhere between 100 and 250,000 people and just had the privilege of being able to say what I thought about a subject. You know, after having been politically engaged for 71 years.
Well,
what kind of a buzz is that?
We can't give you 200,000 people, but we can give you a tent full of people who I'm sure are absolutely bursting with questions. So there is a question there, the lady there in the glasses.
Hello. I'm just wondering, what were your 7 PhDs in, or are they in?
What was my...
Your 7 PhDs.
What are my 7 PhDs?
That's an excellent question.
They're all honorary. It's this thing. Of course they are. Of course they are. My son said, I spent 3 years at Birmingham University studying civil engineering for a bloody ordinary civil engineering degree. What's it called? BA. You swank about on the telly and get... 7 PhDs. No, I think the idea is that you're flattered by the university, who recognises that you might have done something that they approve of. And in my case, it's public education. That's really what I'm given those degrees for, I think. But also that I will, A, be entertaining at the degree ceremony, and hopefully imbue the students who are about to leave in some kind of guiding Burkean principles. I think that's
Burkean principles.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I'm trying to think of a funny book. Who should I? Oh, Kathy Burke rather than Edmund Burke.
Hi, Tony. You talked about your dad being in the Air Force.
Yeah.
And I was in the Air Force, and we watched Blackadder, and it became part of our culture. And Blackadder Goes Forth in 1990 was something that we watched before we went to war in the first Gulf War in 1991. And I can tell you that there are recordings of people going over the battlefield, and they are quoting Blackadder quotes as people are trying to kill them. And no, but I think it's so important, because for us, it was a part of history and reality. And so I still listen to those recordings, and I think about you and what your dad did. Do you ever understand what influence you had on some of us that also served after your dad?
I think rather like a footballer saying it wasn't about me scoring the goals, it was about the team. I think I genuinely think of the Adder very much as collective activity. But in a way, I suppose the one thing we haven't talked about much, although in a way everything we've been talking about, is this magic of this thing called culture. That we all share. And I think it's one of the great things about being British is the English language, and the fact that there is such depth in this language that we all share. And we can say these really quite arcane things, and you and I can joke in a really rather kind of obscure way, but we all get what each other is talking about on a multiplicity of levels. And you saying, you know, these guys possibly the last thing they'll ever say is something out of Blackadder. Why are they saying that? What is that kind of unifying thing? What is that humour in the face of death? It's wonderful, and to be a working person in that industry and to have been had some kind of contribution towards it on a British scale.
It's amazing because a large part of the way that people have always coped with war, and perhaps in the First World War more than any other, was with a kind of gallows humour.
Yeah.
And that Blackadder Goes Forth was true enough to that spirit that it now plays a similar role for people going into combat is an astonishing achievement. And you say, it's as a cultural achievement, it's astonishing.
Yeah, I've had conversations with people in hospices, and the underlying conversation has been about the fact that they won't be here in a couple of weeks' time. And they'll have wanted to enjoy quoting Blackadder and, like, quoting most of it and then waiting for me to say the punchline, and I have no bloody idea. I can't remember it at all. And that kind of thing, we share that as a species, isn't it? Yeah. I've been out for Comic Relief. I've been out in Africa talking to Maasai, who I knew wouldn't be there in a few weeks' time. But the whole way they talked to me, and they'd got no idea who I was at all. But it was all about that kind of laughing and frisking and banter that people communicate in a lot of the time.
Let's have someone in the back. Can someone, the gentleman there with the hand up in the, is it a pink shirt? Oh, I'm sorry, sir. Yeah.
Tony, big fan, but sort of, you're talking quite commercially. Obviously, Blackadder is a big input on many people here. I've got a friend of mine from Australia who thinks in the early 90s you might have actually been the equivalent of CBBCs in Australia. Did you know that, or is that true, or is that some royalties issue you need to discover about?
I think there was it's incredible in Australia. Australia, by and large, absolutely adore Time Team, don't they? I really feel like I'm a superstar when I go out to Australia. And one of the reasons that I'm so popular is that a series which not many of you will remember here, but which was shown time and time again in Australia, was called Tales of Fat Tulip's Garden. And it was a series...
Fat Tulip's Garden, you've got the right answer. That's what Alan was
struggling to
remember.
And and that was the first thing I ever created on my own. And it was a semi-improvised series that took place in this garden with lots of funny, quirky animals and human beings in, and it was for Central Television, and it was, yeah, and I was enormously proud of that because I created it on my own.
Gentleman there.
An inevitable question, I'm afraid, Tony. Blackadder Goes Forth, final episode, final scene, very moving for everybody who watched it. How was it for you and the team to perform?
It was quite ridiculous, really. If you can imagine, when you're filming something like that, certainly back in the 90s, you had to get it all in the can by 10 o'clock. If you didn't, the engineers would pull the switches and you would lose the whole episode. So, in a sense, everything was dominated by that. Now, in that last episode, for the reasons that we've just discussed, we knew there would have to be a no man's land. We knew all of us would have to die at the end. There was no room in the big studio at the BBC for that set. We had to have a second studio. By 9:45 in the first studio, we'd done all of that last episode except the last scene in no man's land. We had to race over as fast as we could to the other studio, where we found no man's land, and the set designers had been governed by the same time constraints as we'd have. So it wasn't properly finished, it was half painted, it was made out of polystyrene, and it was then all painted black and muddy, except a lot of the white polystyrene still showed through. Off I go again. If you can imagine, the no man's land was like this, and there was this sort of dip down here, and down here there was all of us waiting to go over the top. And then the director said, action, and we all climbed up and started running forward into no man's land, except, you know, those ladders that you went up the trenches in. My webbing got stuck in the top of the ladder. So I'm going like this, and I'm not actually moving forwards. I'm like the roadrunner, and they're all getting further and further ahead of me. And if you ever see that episode again, you'll see that I'm way, way back. And then eventually the director went bang, 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 because the sound was going to be dubbed on afterwards. And we all dropped to the ground, except because it was made of polystyrene, we all bounced. And that was it. That's all we'd got time for. It was 10 o'clock, boom, that's it. So we found John Lloyd, the producer, who you know very well from uni, and the director and the editor were left with this massive post-production problem. And we went away and we saw it just as you did in that when it was first transmitted. And what they did, as we went over the top, they slowed it all down into slow-mo and reduced it to black and white. So it looked like something out of the olden days and made it all grainy. All of this was obscuring the shortcomings of the set. And then they threw up these howitzers, which of course blinded the eye, so you really couldn't see what was happening at all. Then from Howard Goodall, they commissioned this beautiful solo trumpet version of the Blackadder theme tune. So while all this was going on, you could just hear ba, 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 ba. So it was just like the last post, really elegiac. And then as we fell, before we hit the ground, the picture froze. Then slowly it mixed to the fields of Flanders. And then gradually they brought the colour in, the green of the fields of Flanders, which was a big shock to the eye because of the howitzers and the black and white. And then, bom, 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 they brought the blood red of the poppies in. And then one thing you may have not noticed, there are no final credits in that final episode. It just goes, beep, 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 beat, the end. And out of such cock-ups, great art is made.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.